order today we have with us Representative Moses, Representative Holm, Representative Kelly, Representative Foster, Representative and Co-Chairman Schnoll, Representative Hocker, Representative Weirach, and Representative Croft. And Representative Croft, you have a helper today.
Yeah, Shannon's here to help out.
Shannon Croft, all right, welcome, Shannon. Today's April 15th. Hope everyone's done their taxes. It's 1:45. Apologize for the late start. We were waiting for a CES, the first delivery that will be taken up, House Bill 71. So, let's see. House Bill 71, as I said, we do have a new CES. And I think we have Mr. Porter here at the Department of Revenue, who can only stay till 2. So if there's any revenue questions, you may want to take care of those first. But first I'll ask my trusty staff, chief of staff, Suzanne, to explain what the new CES does.
Thank you. For the record, Suzanne Cunningham, staff to Representative Meyer. When this bill was previously heard on Monday, there was concerns about the ability to potentially collect 80% of incentives. So we went back with legal services and with the Department of Revenue and clarified what the incentives are to be. And these changes can be found under Section 1, Page 1, and it limits 20% of the total exploration expenditures only under C of this section, and that pertains to the 3 miles. Subparagraph 2 is 20% of the total exploration expenditures that qualify only under D of this section, which is the 25 miles on the outer boundary. Subparagraph 3 is 40% of the total exploration expenditures that qualify under both C and D.
I hate to interrupt, but we need to have a motion to get the CS department represented. Sorry, Co-Chairman Schnoll.
Thank you, Representative Meyer. I make a motion that we accept before the committee CS for House Bill 71, Word Draft 24-PH1040/P4-15.
Okay, any objections? Seeing none? Okay, that's the floor. Okay.
Thank you. So the subparagraph 3, the 40% of the total exploration expenditures that qualify under both C and D, which is both the 3 mile and the 25 mile. Subparagraph 4 is the 40% of the total exploration expenditures that qualify only under E of this section, and E pertains to the seismic exploration. So what we have here, by limiting it to only in each of these subparagraphs, it prohibits them from actually layering incentives upon each other to reach that 80% threshold, which the committee members were concerned about. And the other work that was done on this legislation was the incorporation of the Cook Inlet area for work performed on or after July 1st, 2005 and before July 1st, 2010. And the other change that was made incorporated changes that were made in the House Resources version of the bill, which added the Nanana Basin area to this legislation. We had heard testimony that there was interest in having the Healy area added, and also following that up was the Red Dog area. So what we came to a compromise on was that areas south of 68 degrees, 15 minutes, we're eligible for these incentives on exploration and production. So that takes the North Slope and ANWR off the table for these incentives.
Okay, but it does include the Red Dog area.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Basically excluding everything but the North Slope. That includes the Red Dog. Okay. Why don't we go ahead, and then I'm going to ask Co-Chairman Schnoll to explain the changes to Cook Inlet. But why don't we go ahead and have the Department of Revenue come up. Mr. Porter or Mr. Burnett, either could you join us, please?
You should be.
Okay. For the
record, my name is Steve Porter, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. I would like to address kind of some principles related to this tax credit and any basically substantive questions that you have. I think I have Dan Dickinson, who is our tax director online from our in our office in Anchorage. I basically defer to him. As I was talking to the chair before the meeting, the thing on tax credits you need to be aware, I mean, in terms of from our perspective, the way we approach tax credits is we look at the reservoirs. What reservoirs in the state need assistance? I mean, that's the first hurdle you got to make. And if we are not getting good exploration in a particular area, and we have what we believe are decent prospects, that means that an incentive may be appropriate. That decision discussion should happen with the Department of Natural Resources. The Department of Natural Resources, from a state standpoint, is the expert on what's under the ground. I mean, they have the information, and a discussion about with them on the prospective areas around the state, wherever they may be, the whole state or part of the state, North Slope or South, should occur. And once that discussion occurs and you determine what areas of the state are prospective, you want to see exploration, then you come to the Department basically the Department of Revenue. We can sit down at that point, determine the level of basically incentive that you want to provide and make sure that the incentive design specifically hits the benefit of the taxpayer. And that's our job. That's what we do. So, and your job from a policy standpoint, I don't need to tell you, is to basically make the policy call on the areas after you talk to the Department of Natural Resources of what areas you want to incentivize. At the present time, you know, there's a discussion about whether or not to incentivize areas of the North Slope beyond that's already been incentivized. The question that I would pose to you would be to sit down with the Department of Natural Resources and ask, what kind of exploration are you getting on the North Slope? And there isn't a lot. And do we consider the North Slope prospective? And the answer is, I think so. And is there some additional things that we can do to basically encourage that exploration? And interesting, just as a side, what you might do is to sit down, and I appreciate the external affairs guys from the oil companies, but if you really want to understand the excitement and views of the North Slope, if you could get an exploration manager in here that actually has you know, day in, day out, has to deal with trying to explore for gas or oil on the North Slope, they will tell you what kind of incentives, what kind of benefit those incentives are to their exploration programs and how it helps them, you know, basically get a project approved and get it drilled. That's basically all I wanted to say on the overall policy, and I would be willing to answer any questions that you have, and Dan Dickinson is available to answer any specifics on the specific piece of legislation.
Okay. I guess I'm just a little confused in the sense that this is the governor's bill, and the only area that has come forth basically was the Bristol Bay area.
Certainly.
And I assume that was because there's a lease sale coming up shortly.
That's correct. And we do support that.
And then through the process here, it's like many bills, it's kind of become a Christmas tree, and people have added various Nanana Basin and Red Dog area, and et cetera. I don't think, from a policy standpoint, I think we want to encourage as much exploration and production as possible. If they're not looking, they're not going to find anything. And even if they don't find anything, it still creates jobs and helps the overall state economy.
Right.
But I don't know what areas on the North Slope we should add to this. If we rely on you guys being the governor's office,
right,
to tell us what areas to include here. So basically we just said, okay, let's just say south of the Brooks Range. But if you're telling me we should go in the areas in the North Slope, then we need some help.
Yeah. I appreciate that, Chair. The comments were more geared to, I know that there's the bill has kind of been expanding into different areas, and really it was from a Department of Revenue standpoint, trying to help you understand our perspective on all those different areas. Where those areas and expansions are policy calls. We think that those decisions on how to expand this bill or not expand this bill should be based on conversations with the Department of Natural Resources on the prospectivity of those different areas. And if they are prospective, they need incentives, then it makes sense to go ahead and proceed ahead with them. I think that's the main intent of that conversation. But it's basically not so much of let's just include the areas, but a conscious process that you need to go through to expand this bill beyond what it already is.
Okay. Any questions for Department of Revenue?
Mr. Chair, Jerry Burnett, the Special Assistant to the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. I have one question I'd like to for clarification. Section 8, where you, in the new CS, says the provisions of this section do not apply to taxes applicable under this chapter attributable to production from oil and gas produced from an oil and gas lease or gas produced on a gas-only lease located north of 68 degrees 15 minutes north latitude on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Is it the intent from this section to take away that credit immediately, or is that allowing, or is this now that credit for those taxes, or is it meant to be exploration? Because right now, under the law, you can have the exploration credit earned in one area of the state and take it away from taxes that are being paid on production in another area of the state. And I think this would be a major change in the way the tax credit incentive works. And I'm not sure that that's what you intended to do.
I'll try to speak to that. Okay. I don't think it was our intention to take away any tax credit that's currently available. I think that, and I didn't draft this portion of it, but I think the real issue there was not to allow the credits that we're proposing to apply to any area north of 68, 15 minutes, or Anwar. I believe that was the intent, I believe, if my memory is correct. I'm getting a nod from...
I could have Ms. Cunningham come back up, but I think that's... Ms. Cunningham, you want to come back up here?
As I read this, it kills it immediately.
For the record, Suzanne Cunningham, staff to Representative Meyer. Again, that is correct. The intent was not to basically adversely impact areas that are currently within that would currently have their incentives expire on 2007, or the opportunity for the incentives to expire on 2007. It was to extend the areas south of 68 degrees 15 minutes to 2010. So I believe that a conceptual amendment would be in order there to clarify that, if that's...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's what I'm concerned about, is the way it's written. And I don't know if Dan Dickinson is online and if he's had a chance to read this language, but...
Mr. Dickinson. Yeah.
Handed to me, but I believe that the point raised by Mr. Burnett is correct. In other words, what Section L on page 6 will do, it says it, you know, this section, which I believe is 4355025, you know, will not apply to things north of 6815. That's, of course, the current bill allows and you know, still allows exploration north of the Brooks Range through 2007 to qualify. So I believe a conceptual amendment would be in order if this was just meant to extend. There is a second, slightly different question, which is the a more nuanced one, which is, are we talking about the exploration north of the Brooks Range, which you don't want to qualify between 2007 and 2010, or that you can't apply it against credits for production on the north in the north of the Brooks Range between 2007 and 2010?
Can I ask about that? So it seems to me what I'm fine with doing a conceptual amendment, but it's such a tricky area. I want to know exactly what we mean. It's really Section 8 ought to say, the provision, anything north of 68 degrees 15 minutes expires in 2007. The others have the other provisions. But we don't mean to get rid of them, we just say they have their normal, regular expiration dates. And then so I wanted, I guess, Dan to tell me that that was right, and then I think we're much clearer about what we want Section 8 to be.
Mr. Dixon, did you hear President Cross' comments?
Representative Cross, through the chair. Yes. I believe if what you're only focused on is the exploration, then you'd have, and I won't do the drafting here, but the notion is you've captured it precisely, yes. So I mean, just to take that one step further, there needn't be any restriction on the oil to which it applies, because what that does is that makes the credit less saleable. In other words, if I'm a small explorer, I come up here, I drill a couple of holes, I get a credit for one or two of them, but I find nothing. The only way I can monetize this credit is by selling it to somebody who does have to pay production tax. And so if we limited the oil against which it can apply, you'll be lessening the value of the credit. Now, normally in markets it trades at 97, 98 cents on the dollar, so a explorer is able to monetize essentially the full amount. If you restrict to whom that explorer could sell the credit, the value would drop. So I think if all you're focused on is the exploration, then that's precisely right.
Okay. Explain to me then, how does this impact the production side?
Mr. Chairman, it's my belief that you don't need to impact the production side at all.
Okay.
The credit can be taken by someone who has production tax. If it's someone who is already producing and they go out and explore, then they'll take it against their own production tax. If it is someone who is not producing or doesn't have sufficient production taxes, let's say they're producing oil in the Cook Inlet, for which there are no production taxes, then what they'll do is they'll sell their credit to someone else. And I don't think it's anyone's intent to restrict the market for selling the credit.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Dickinson. Mr. Dixon, have you had a chance to look at the CS? I know you probably just got it faxed to you.
That's correct. And just for the record, I'm Dan Dickinson, Director of the Tax Division of the Department of Revenue. I have just got it and am going through it. There are a couple of minor points I could bring up, but fundamentally I think it does exactly what you and Representative Chenault have described.
Okay, well we'll come back to Section 8 and make the necessary amendment to correct that. I'm going to ask Representative Chenault now to explain the Cook Inlet section of the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of different issues, and I haven't, unlike you, I've just got the CS in front of me. But some of the basic issues there was it would extend, for the Cook Inlet area, it would extend the dates from the 2003 incentive credits out to 2010 for the Cook Inlet Basin. It also provides language that allows exploration wells in the Cook Inlet to be within the three-mile limit, subject to review and approval by the commissioner, and that would provide 20% credit. It also would take the language and decrease the 25-mile boundary limit to 10 miles for the Cook Inlet Basin. And that's simply because it's such a mature basin. Many wells have been drilled over the last 50 years, or close to 50 years. And because of the size of the basin and the exploration that's happened in the basin over that period of time, the 25-mile boundary limit that was instituted in Senate Bill 185 does not really apply to it. I think that's the major additions to it, to 71.
Representative Chenault, if I could add one other unique aspect of the Cook Inlet. This is Dan Dickinson again.
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
There's also a $20 million limit for the amount of credits granted in the Cook Inlet under these special rules.
And you are correct, Dan.
Okay, is there any additional questions for Representative Chenault, Mr. Dickinson? I think what I'd like to do here, since we just got this CS, this is a fairly complicated issue. And we want to do it right. I want to set this aside. We'll take that We'll go ahead and do the next two bills and then come back to this one, give people a chance to read the CS a little bit and be a little more comfortable with it. Give Mr. Dickinson a chance and the Department of Revenue a chance to read it. Give the members here a chance to occasionally glance at it as we study the other bills.
Just a question. I'm just going through this. Chair Chenault, the reference to the Cook Inlet that lightened up the requirements there because of the mature field. In the cases where we do that, I assume there's more than one condition in here, but do we give that power to the commissioner in each case where we've slackened the rules?
It's my belief that the three modeling would be one issue there where we would give the commissioner the ability to look at it and either approve or not approve. I'm thinking that is the give completely clear. I'm thinking that is the area, the three mile limit area that would, the commissioner would have to say.
So the 10 mile would be statutory.
20. Yeah, I believe that it would, but without looking at it to further make that statement, I'd hate to say that.
Maybe I can come back to that, Chairman.
I'll try to get that out.
Okay, let's just set this aside. I would like to revisit that, and hopefully, if everyone's comfortable, move House Bill 71 out today. But I don't want to rush through that one. So let's go on to the next bill, another fine bill, House Bill 33. I'm going to ask trustee staffer, Mike Kowalski, or is that known as Mr. Fish, to come forward. Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'll go ahead and make some brief remarks about the bill, and then we'll turn over to Mr. Kowalski here to fill in the hole for that bill. We do have several people to testify: Connie Marshall, the Small Business Administration; Wayne Stevens, president of looks like he's here, president of the Alaska State Chamber; Chris Kennedy, assistant AG; and Kristen Ryan with the DEC. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll just to give a brief history of this bill, where it came from. This has to do with Congress back in 1980, passed what was called the Regulatory Flexibility Act, which mandated that agencies consider the impact on their regulations on small business. And based on that success of the federal program, it saved over $21 billion is what it was estimated. But based on that, the Federal Program Office of Advocacy has drafted some model legislation for states to follow, and over 37 states have followed such legislation. They've found a lot of success with the program. And the premise of it is that first, the regulatory agencies should consider the impact of their regulations on small business. And second is that the regulatory agencies should have the freedom to evaluate alternative methods of meeting the same goals when regulations apply to small business. So that's kind of the nutshell of this bill. It's not intended to have agencies hire scores of economists to prepare impact statements for the regulations, but simply use the information that they already have available to them. We certainly don't want to add any more expense to agencies, but simply want to protect small business from the regulations that affect small business. So, Mr. Kowalski, that's kind of the bill in a nutshell. Is there anything, any details I forgot that you want to add, Mr. Kowalski?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Michael Kowalski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer. I think you've done a very good job of describing the intent of the bill. If the committee would like, I can walk through the steps on essentially how the process works and how the bill incorporates itself into the regulatory process. But other than that, I think you've done a very good job.
Okay. So. Well, briefly, if you could walk us through it, that might be helpful.
In committee members' packets, you should have a chart that is steps in the regulatory process. And it's a flow chart that I have taken from the drafting manual for administrative regulations. And on it, The shaded portions are what House Bill 33 would do to change the regulatory process. If you notice from this flowchart, the process of adopting and drafting regulations is not a simple one. I think all of us are aware that it's a long process. The first step is the planning and decision-making process, and in that step, several of the general ideas that are gotten to in a regulatory flexibility analysis are discussed. Then an agency develops their draft regulations in step two, starts to work on their public notice, and then in step three consults with the agency attorney. In step four, the agency contacts the Department of Law, and the Department of Law opens a file. Here is where the regulatory agency would contact the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And there, the department would prepare to advise and assist the regulatory agency, sort of provide a check that says, well, you're directed by the statute to fulfill a certain statutory objective. You should take a moment and consider, perhaps, the reality of implementing that regulation on the ground. And I'm sure many of you are aware and familiar with regulations written with perhaps the best intent that when they come to the real world have no real applicability, and in fact, for a small business, a significant amount of cost to comply with it. So the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development will assist that regulatory agency through the public comment process, come back after the public comment process, and take information that is gathered through that public comment process, advice from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, and information that is already in the agency's files, to ask a series of formalized questions. And I think one of the reasons that around other states, and Connie Marshall can perhaps testify to this later, other states have gone to this formalized step-by-step process is that in 1995, the state of Alaska passed a House Bill 130. And what that did was it said that an agency must pay special consideration to the cost to private persons of a proposed regulation. 9 years on, I'm not sure how well that has actually worked. And the reason to do it in statute in other states in the discussion is that you provide a very stringent set of legislative objectives saying that we want you to meet the objectives of statute, but at the same time we want you to be smart about the way you do it and at least consider alternative methods of getting there. Having done this then, followed through with the public comment period, the agency can then adopt the regulation and move forward. The secondary benefit for our state in particular is that the regulatory review committee that was set up by the legislature can have access to this information in its deliberations, looking back to whether or not an appropriate regulatory action was taken. What were the options? What was considered? And there's an ancillary benefit to the legislature coming back that way. In the process, I think it's very important to say you cannot in any way legislate common sense to an agency. I think the question is, can you give them the freedom to and encouragement to consider alternative methods? And if we can reduce the cost of compliance to small businesses of regulations the way other states have and the way the national government has, I think the benefits to the state are wide-reaching. With that, I'd stop.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pulaski. And Mr. Pulaski, it's my understanding that in almost all the other states that we've researched, we said there's 37 that have such a law. Most of them did not have a fiscal note, or if they did, it was less than $100,000 or $200,000. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is correct. Most states that have done this, the place where a fiscal note has been attached is traditionally for the position in the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, or equivalent agency, and that creates sort of what is the office of a small business advocate, a person whose sort of sole purpose it is to look out for the interest of small business in government. And I believe also in your packet is a breakdown of how many businesses and how many employees that is in the state. And it's well over 170,000 employed Alaskans work for businesses that would be covered under this regulation. This statute. So the places where there has been a cost is really in that position or supporting a regulatory review committee.
Okay, and then just to follow up, Cho, your amendment number one would pretty much wipe out most of the fiscal that people may have in their packet and may feel intimidated by it.
Through the chair, yes, that is correct, Representative Meyer, but I would ask that agencies be allowed to respond to that themselves.
Certainly will. Any questions for Mr. Ross? Okay, seeing none, then let's go to public testimony. Let's see, Connie Marshall, you should be online.
I am online.
Good afternoon, Connie.
Good afternoon. Chairman Chenal, Chairman Meyer, and members of the Finance Committee, my name is Connie Marshall, and I'm the regional advocate for the U.S. Small Business Administration's Office of Advocacy in Region 10, which includes Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. It is my honor to speak to you today and testify on House Bill 33. I will provide an overview on how this idea is working nationwide. As the regional advocate for Region 10, my job is to be the direct link between state and local governments, small business groups, small business owners and employees, and the Office of Advocacy in D.C. My chief concern is to help identify regulatory concerns of small business by monitoring the impact of federal and state policies at the grassroots level. It's my goal to see the programs and policies that encourage fair regulatory treatment of small businesses are developed and implemented to ensure future growth and prosperity. That is why I'm testifying in support of the proposed legislation. The Office of Advocacy enforces the Regulatory Flexibility Act on the federal level in order to lessen the regulatory burden on small business. More than 93% of businesses in every state are small businesses. As you may know, small businesses with less than 20 employees spend nearly $7,000 every year per employee to comply with federal regulations. By working with the federal agencies to implement the RFA, in the year 2004, the Office of Advocacy saved small businesses nationwide over $17 billion in foregone regulatory costs that can now be used to create jobs, buy equipment, expand access to health care, or just simply maintain competitiveness. While some states have state regulatory flexibility legislation that mandates state agencies to perform economic impact analysis before they regulate, many do not. Successful state-level regulatory flexibility law should have five critical elements. Number one, a small business definition, which is the same as Alaska's definition in your case. A requirement that state agencies perform an economic impact analysis before they regulate. A requirement that state agencies consider less burdensome alternatives. A judicial review so that the law has teeth. And a provision for state government to periodically review all its regulations. To be effective, there should be few, if any, exemptions from the law. During this time of tight state budgets, you may be wondering how much it costs a state to implement regulatory flexibility. The answer is that implementing regulatory flexibility can be done at little or no additional cost. And I'll share with you three states that have recently implemented the RFA. In North Dakota, agencies were granted no additional funds to carry out their duties. The State Legislative Review Committee is responsible for reviewing the regulations that their state agencies, using economic impact analysis, have determined might be overly burdensome. So other than additional regulations for the committee to review, North Dakota has simply absorbed the new duties. Similarly, in Colorado, agencies were granted no additional funds to carry out their duties under the new RFA legislation. Their Office of Policy Research and Regulatory Review in Colorado's Department of Regulatory Agencies was given responsibility for implementing the new law. To meet the new obligations, they shifted personnel in their office and dedicated part of an IT person to implement their e-rulemaking notification system. In Oklahoma, the fiscal note estimated that it would cost $75,000 per year to support the Small Business Regulatory Review Committee in the Department of Commerce and to implement the regulatory flexibility law. Since implementation began in 2002, the Department of Commerce has not exceeded the budget. Mainly, their expenditures have been for printing, marketing materials, travel compensation for the review committee members, and compensation for the committee coordinator's time. The benefits of implementing a regulatory flexibility system truly outweigh the cost. In my written testimony that you should have copies of, you will find an example of how the regulatory flexibility works in New York. And I'm not going to go over that because if you're interested, you can just read that. Since December of 2002, my fellow regional advocates across the country have been working with legislators like you to make regulatory flexibility for small business a legislative priority. In 2003, 12 states introduced regulatory flexibility, and governors in North Dakota, Colorado signed the regulatory flexibility legislation into law, and Massachusetts governor and West Virginia's governor signed executive orders. In 2004, 17 states introduced regulatory flexibility, and to date, seven signed it into law. And to date, in 2005, 18 states have introduced regulatory flexibility legislation, and Virginia's governor and New Mexico's governor recently signed regulatory flexibility into law. And also this year, Arkansas's governor signed an executive order. One of the many reasons I believe that this legislation has been so successful over the last couple of years is because policymakers across the country are realizing that regulatory flexibility is an economic development tool. There are over 23 million small businesses in the United States, and they are the job creators. Small firms create between 60 to 80% of all the net new jobs. There's no question that small business is the backbone of the economy there in Alaska, just as it is throughout the country. This legislation is good for small business in Alaska, and the Office of Advocacy commends you for bringing House Bill 33 forward. Thank you again for hearing my testimony.
Okay, thank you, Connie, for joining us today. Are you in Seattle, or where are you?
I am in Seattle today.
Okay, very good. Don't see any questions for you, but if you can stay online, that would be helpful.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Stevens, President of the Alaska State Chamber. Join us, please. And for the record, tell us who you are and who you're affiliated with, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Wayne Stevens. I'm the president of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. Alaska State Chamber of Commerce urges the legislature and administration to create and maintain an efficient, expedient regulatory environment which is supportive of business investment and development and encourage businesses to locate and grow in Alaska. The Alaska Chamber urges the legislature and administration to provide an effective oversight mechanism to ensure regulations are producing effective results that follow in legislative intent and that agencies are carrying out their responsibilities for permitting, oversight, and compliance. The Chamber urges the legislature to reduce, clarify, and simplify regulations within the state of Alaska with the intent of reducing administrative costs and time within state government and Alaska business. We believe this bill will accomplish these goals. The Alaska State Chamber encourages passage of committee substitute for House Bill 33. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. Any questions? Sina, thank you. Thanks for joining us. Kristen Ryan, did you want to testify? Are you here for questions? Or?
Testify briefly.
Or do you want to talk about
pesticides?
That's
next.
I think Representative Holm has a question.
Whenever he'd like to ask.
You should like this bill, though. Go ahead, Kristen.
For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan, Division Director of Environmental Health for DEC. It's only my division from the department impacted by this bill, and based on the amendments that have been proposed today, we would suggest our fiscal note being zeroed out, or the department can provide a zero fiscal note, however you choose. That's all.
Very good. That's just the fiscal note. You don't want to zero out the whole department.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Representative Holm had that. Representative
Kelly. Mr. Chairman, I can either ask this here or ask the general question of having the exceptions from the law addressed, but whichever way you want to do it.
I think I'll bring the sponsor back up, or I guess I'm the sponsor, but the sponsor staff, but when we get there, I think that is the last person to test. Okay, Mike?
Come on. Sure. Or Representative Stoltz, do you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I would have had some questions, but your staff said that we can't legislate common sense, so that closed off the whole avenue.
Okay, let's see. Yeah, Sally Sadler is online, or no, you're here for questions?
Just questions.
Questions, okay, good. I just want to make sure. Is anybody else who wanted to testify on this? Okay, we'll go ahead and close public testimony then, and Mr. Pulaski, did you hear Representative Kelly's question?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, I did, but I would ask that we sort of clarify where you would like me to start off with the exceptions, to discuss the intent behind them and the process that the bill has gone through.
Well, the concern I have is that we would hope that there'd be few exceptions, as mentioned by the previous witness or the testimony. I'm just curious why we're exempting certain ones, and there must be a reason for that. But I'd like to hear it. And for example, DEC can cause business a lot of headaches, and they've got some exemptions, and it must make sense to you. So,
through the chair, Representative Kelly, this bill has been through quite a long process and a lot of discussion. And one of the main reasons that we've gone to, in the beginning, a limited application is that the issues of permit applications and regulations in Alaska, on the one hand, that we know that they cost small business, we know that there are many, many interests that like to manipulate any crack in the system to stop development, stymie development, and on the broader level of resource development, that raises some very troubling issues. For example, if you are considering the issuance of, say, an air permit for Alpine, should you consider the impact on a guiding business downriver, and does that override? Is there a judicial review provision to come back in and challenge that? The questions that it could create in terms of the natural resource sector development interest was something that perhaps it was just something that we wanted to take off the table through discussions, is that previous committees and the sponsor through discussions just didn't want to go there. On the other side of things, well, that's essentially about it. It's natural resources that were taken off the table. And fishing side, it's small businesses. You have emergency regulations. Any allocation decision made by the Board of Fish or Board of Game is inherently an allocation decision.
Of the 37 states, Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. of the 37 states, Mike, how many of them did the same thing?
Several, actually. You find in states that are heavily resource development states, I believe in your packet is a map of the states that have adopted regulatory flexibility, you see Wyoming is one of the primary ones that has not. And I feel that probably one of the main reasons is that they are wrestling with the very same question. Is how do you consider the impact on the resource development sector, which we all rely on and affects so much of our economy?
So several, three, five, seven, somewhere in there?
Somewhere in there, Representative Kelly. I could go through the laws and get the information for you. But
The other 30,
it really varies through the chair, Representative Kelly, on each state. States have found small exemptions that, for that state in particular, works. I believe it was Maryland actually did something with their fishing industry, and I'm speaking from recollection, but each state has made a very careful distinction, and I think in every single circumstance you will find some exceptions. The idea being that it should apply to all, but as the Connie, the federal representative, has said, but the reality on the ground in each state's economy is very different.
Mr. Chairman, just to you, do we capture the 90% of what we were trying to do here with these exceptions?
Representative Kelly, I believe so, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I think we do have a couple amendments that need to be made. Is that correct? I'll go ahead and move Amendment 1.
Okay.
Good. All right. It's been moved and objected to. Mr. Pulaski, do you want to explain?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would ask that I will provide a brief introduction to the amendment, and then that Chris Kennedy from the Department of Law is online to speak to it as well. It is a long amendment, 3 pages. Most of the sections, the page ones, line 14, are conforming language because we have to renumber the bill as you go through. The first primary purpose of amendment number 1 is on page 1, line 12, and that's lines 12 through 15, and that's a clarification in section 1 of the proposed legislation to page 2, line 5. And this is bringing the economic effect statement out of subsection B to a subsection C, clarifying that we do not intend for agencies to go out, get scores of economists, to achieve the studies that are done in or called for in the economic effects statement, that you're using information if available as provided under the B section. And it's a clarification for the agencies that gives them some better direction. And it was the primary concern that we heard back from the agencies, is that the provisions can be implemented, but how we proceed through the studies is really what's at question. And so that's a clarifying amendment there. The second major portion is on page 2 of the amendment, which is to page 3 following line 18. And this really gets to the Department of Health and Social Services. A large portion of the Department of Health and Social Services regulations that they promulgate are related to reimbursement, cost containment, eligibility standards, and those are mandated by the legislature to live within an appropriation budget. And the commissioner came and spoke to Representative Meyer about the issues related to that in this legislation, and that in a reimbursement situation, the small business, the healthcare provider, is of course being hurt because the state is not providing them with as much money. And so this was to clarify that those cost reimbursement regulations are off the table. And that is about the extent of my knowledge on the Healthcare Reimbursement Act rates, but I believe Chris Kennedy online could speak to that much more eloquently.
Okay. Ms. Kennedy, are you online? I don't show you online.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Kennedy, Mr. Kennedy, do you have anything else to add?
Mr. Chairman, I really don't. The health care regulations, I believe that has been worked out between your staff and Commissioner Gilbertson, and about all I know is that the solution is satisfactory to everyone concerned, and so the administration is we're very appreciative that your staff has worked with the commissioner and remains supportive of the bill generally. I would have said something about the first part of the amendment, the part that clarifies that agencies don't need to go and hire consultants, but I think Mr. Pawlowski has covered that in probably in enough detail, although I'm happy to answer questions if there are any.
Okay, thank you. Is there some cross to give a question?
Yeah, just for either Mr. Pawlowski or the other witnesses we have here, the first part makes a lot of sense to me that we're not asking them to do a lot of independent extra economic analysis. We're just taking what they have and trying to say what the effect will be on small business. I guess I'm having more trouble with the second part on page 2 at the bottom. The rates that you require small businesses to provide their services for, in Medicaid, Medicare, all through the HES budget, you say, you will only receive this much for this service. It's cost containment from our perspective, but it's market domination and dictating of payment schedules from the small business perspective. And while I could see that it would take some time, isn't it a central matter for those small businesses involved? The fact that it will take so much time is an indication really of how much we have stepped into affecting small businesses in the health area. And so we're saying, it troubles me to say, because our effect on small business is so pervasive in the health department, it's so complete, it will take us too much time to consider it. It's the very place where you ought to consider it, because where regulations just may add, in other areas, regulations add, some burden or paperwork you have to fill out and all that. In many areas of the HES, and I'm sure other areas that I'm not aware of yet, they're actually telling businesses what they're going to get for providing their services. It goes from a burden to almost defining your business and what you're going to get for it. I'm sure they would be troubled by having to, every time they tell publish a new schedule of what businesses receive for their services, trying to figure out its impact. But it seems to me vital for the people who provide those services. I'm not sure we should shy away from the big one simply because it's big, because it's where we're affecting, and we're affecting them very deeply.
Baker and Crofton, and I know we did discuss this with the commissioner, and he has a very good answer to your question, and I'm hoping it'll come to me, or else maybe Representative Hocker, who has our HESPA, knows the answer.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I certainly don't know what the commissioner's answer was to Frank's passing. I do know that this amendment had been discussed with the Zeltzer staff and the commissioner. He assured me that this took care of his concerns, and quite frankly, I've been applying myself to other endeavors around here, so I wasn't really up to speed. However, that said, the trenchant argument made by Representative Croft, I think, answers itself. Particularly to me, again, that these, you know, these small businesses that are being impacted by these regulations are, in fact, a creation of the very regulations in the department itself. Those, many of these small businesses wouldn't exist without us making the legislative decisions, the policy decisions, the regulatory decisions to provide these services. So in many ways, I think there is a differentiation here between an entrepreneur and small business who is viable on their own, maybe conducting work absolutely unrelated to state activities, as opposed to some of these that we're looking to carve out a little bit of deference for our regulatory process to, when in fact, almost in many ways what we've done is we've, I hesitate to use the word, privatized, because we really have, what we've done is we've outsourced a necessary essential state service. There's a big difference between carving out this exception for outsourced services as opposed to regulations that affect truly private or privatized enterprises. So I support your amendment very strongly.
Okay, thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Croft, I think I would add two things to what Representative Hawker has just said, and that's that at the end of the day, for the legislature, as a policy call, it is a cost-benefit decision, as anything should be. To take an example, say there's $12 million in Medicare cost containment that regulations are intended to get to, $12 million over a year. Regulations have to be drafted to achieve that cost containment and that cost reimbursement. That's $1 million a month, or about $30,000 a day in just rough math. If this process delays the implementation of that regulation by 1 month, 2 months, a week is $210,000 and the state has lost. And the question that I think from a policy call needs to be balanced is that an effective use of state resources, and is there an appropriate benefit to the private sector? Further, the parameters at which we arrive at that number come from the very open and public process that the legislature does on its budget. And when we come out, we make that as a legislature, make this decision that this is the budget that we have to live within. And interested parties come to the legislature, there's not enough for this, there's not enough for this, there's not enough for this. But at the end of the day, that is the policy call that's made that dictates the entire realm in which these regulations are promulgated. So the application to this from a public policy statement is that the consideration needs to be done at the finance level in the approval of the budget, and perhaps not in the implementation of the regulations. And I believe that happens at the regulatory review committee level and during the finance committee structure. And those are the only two things that I would respond to.
Very good. Anything else?
Well, yeah, just interesting discussion. But when the Department of Health and Social Services establishes a new rate under Medicaid for what doctors are going to be paid, or nurses, or picking them, say doctors, if we lower that rate, we see that as a cost containment. It's a savings to us. If by lowering that rate we're able to provide more services to more people, we see that as a benefit to expansion. What is not adequately considered, the premise of this bill, and I agree with, is the effect you're having on the people that are trying to provide that service. We don't adequately look at it in the regulatory process, and sometimes we don't adequately look at it here. Those are done not by legislative pronouncement, but by regulation. The crux of your bill is take a moment to see how it's going to affect small business. In this case, the people providing it. Why shouldn't you, at the point that you say, we're going to cut the amount you get for every doctor's visit by 10%, look at the effect it's going to have on those small businesses and look at whether there would be an alternative way to achieve the result you want. In effect, what we've got here is feedback of, here's an area where we in state government are affecting small business daily almost. And wouldn't it be a lot of work if you asked us to figure out the impact of that? And that work may cost some. And I say, well, if you're the department that is having the biggest impact on small business, I guess and our response is to exempt them out. Here's an area of government where it's so pervasive, the government's impact through Medicaid, Medicare, support for hospitals, all of that, where we have our tentacles even further in, and we want to be sensitive to small business, and yet our reaction is, well, the area that we have the most involvement, that would be too much trouble. And that, I think we need to stay true to the philosophy of the bill and not categorically exempt out those areas where we have the largest impact.
And I think the argument is that that should be done at this level when we set the budget rather than by the regulations. But Mr. Foster.
Through the chair, Representative Croft, if I could make one point of clarification. It is that the cost containment and reimbursement and eligibility regulations, we are not exempting the Department of Health and Social Services from the issues in this bill. We are exempting it when it comes to the cost reimbursement and eligibility decisions which govern the Medicare Medicaid Reimbursement Act. You can find this online. I did not ask that copies were made for the committee, but this is the Department of Health and Social Services proposed regulations to Title VII, amending licensed facilities, community care licenses, assisted living homes, child care facilities. This is the regulations that, per the philosophy of the bill and in the definition of, govern the conduct of small business. You will find in this proposed regulation regulations that are to the fact that if a child mouths a toy, the toy should be sanitized before another child plays with it. There are descriptions for how melon should be cut, and there are descriptions for the size of trash cans, high chairs, on and on and on. This is about 98 pages that govern the conduct of small business. And so at the premise level, that being the difference, that is still included. And that I just offer it as a point of clarification.
So to the small businesses that are providing this service, we're going to say, when we tell you how tall your trash can is going to be, we're going to look at how that affects your business. But when we tell you how much your daily rate is going to be per child, we're not. And that doesn't make any sense. Because one will have the trash can thing can be a pain. The daily rate is significant.
And again, I guess I would argue that the daily rate is more set up by us when we do the budget, whereas the size of the trash can is certainly a regulation that is entirely up to Hess. And Representative Hopper?
It's been observed that the commissioner has not written to the rescue of his amendment.
Oh, okay. Maybe the commissioner would like to join us. Maybe he wouldn't. He's here. I'm sure he wants to. Commissioner, thanks for joining us, for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joel Gilbertson, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, and I apologize to the representative that just wandered in the middle of a question right now, and I believe the question dealt with the amendment that the Chair and I had discussed. The department certainly is interested in legislation and As we looked at the legislation, we became concerned about its possible implications in one scenario, and that is when we move forward with regulations where we are implementing reductions to our programs. For example, there is normally a legislative intent attached to our budget on an annual basis that deals with the situation of the appropriation for the Medicaid program. And in years in which the appropriation is insufficient for the operation of the Medicaid program, the department is directed through regulation to reduce services, sometimes through eligibility, sometimes through rate, sometimes through optional services, to implement the budget target of the legislature. Sometimes the direction is very overt. It's an actual reduction in the operating budget that is to be achieved through the promulgation of regulations within the department. As we engage in that regulating fashion from the department, as we move forward in promulgating those regulations, those are largely around rates. And sometimes they're around the way in which we pay providers or calculate costs for providers if they're on a cost-based reimbursement basis. Our concern as a department is that if we have delays in implementing those regulations, which whenever you are doing reductions, I think are going to have an impact. They're going to have an impact on the provider naturally. We're going to be paying them less. We're going to be reducing the way we reimburse the entity. And we have a number of small businesses that we interact with as a department, assisted living providers, personal care tenant providers, clinics, physician offices, every physician office that we deal with. Every day that we delay in getting those regulations implemented costs the state and creates fiscal liability for the state. Some of our regulation packages and some of the reductions have been in the magnitude of $10 to $15 million, which means the monthly savings is over $1 million in some cases in terms of the fiscal cost to the state. So as a department, we did make a request to the co-chair to consider an amendment that would allow us to continue in regulations that we promulgate, not all of our regulations, but in regulations that we are promulgating specifically for the purpose of dealing with reimbursement or how we are paying providers, that those are ones that we can move quickly towards implementing because those are essentially codification of direction the legislature has already given us. Other regulations that we put forward, which is a host of regulation as well, such as regulations around safety, regulations around child care centers, different regulations we do on a routine basis, those would still fall under the purview of this legislation.
Question? Sure. If we direct that you should achieve some measure of cost savings, and you are looking at reducing rates or restricting eligibility or other changes in the methods of reimbursement, wouldn't it be appropriate, as you balance those, and they have differing effects on the people receiving the services, but they also have different effects on the people providing the services, the small business, shouldn't that countervailing consideration be there? We know, because it seems to me there's a tendency to say, well, the rates only primarily affect the providers, and I really don't want to restrict eligibility, I'd rather not. But that's the exact balance I think that I'd like you to consider as a regulatory entity. If I just cut rates, and by doing so allow eligibility to stay relatively broad, that looks good, but its effect on the providers is bad. Restricting eligibility and keeping the rates the same has an impact on those groups of people that are now excluded. And I want you to consider both ends of those, and I'm worried somewhat that your good concern for the people receiving the services isn't balanced when it needs to be about the people who are providing the services.
Responding to the chair, Representative Croft, I think we're always doing a balancing act, particularly as we go through the budget process with the legislature, looking at ways in which we balance the various needs of the program. Ultimately, we're focusing on what's in the best interest of the beneficiary, the person that we exist for, the person we're providing services to. And there become those points when, either through eligibility or through rates or through the way the services are available, we create barriers that prevents a person from receiving a service. For example, if your rates are too low, you can't get into a doctor's office. Those are balances that are always occurring as we go forward. Those go forward as we develop concepts of how we want to achieve savings to meet the budget targets that are put forward by the legislature. I can say, as we move forward in looking at the reimbursement issue, across the Medicaid program, what you'll find is that we'll have a variety of providers, a variety of sizes, who fall under those regulations. You could have a large hospital system with 3,000 employees and a small provider with 4 or 5 employees, perhaps, all falling under the governance of these regulations that come out, because they're all involved in providing that type of healthcare service. Federal law does not allow us to create different payment policies and different reimbursement based on the size of the provider. So as we go through that analysis for the small business versus the larger business, we would still be required through the requirements of the federal program, the Medicaid program, to treat the providers equally, to have the same regulatory scheme for both of them.
If I may just add one point for discussion. If benefits and costs are reduced on the govern the conduct side, then the amount that's required for reimbursement goes down, and you can benefit the business and the state at the end of the day. Because the cost of running a business that gets wrapped into the rate that needs to be reimbursed is partly from complying with regulations that govern the conduct. And so I believe we're still reaching a benefit to the business by addressing the other regulations that are not exempt.
Work on that for a while. That was a tough sentence.
Yeah, that's pretty heavy. All right. Thank you, though, Mr. Boston. Any other questions, concerns? I think, actually, Representative Stoltz had the objection. Gone. So
I'll remove it.
Does any committee members have any objections to the amendment? Okay, we'll go ahead and adopt Amendment 1. Okay, Amendment 2. I'll move that. The title. Commissioner, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. I apologize for coming in the middle.
No problem. Mr. Pulaski, we just simply tighten the title there so we can't things don't happen to us today.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. And we had asked that it be a conceptual amendment, just to clarify in case there's a problem that legal needs to work with on this.
Okay. Any questions, concerns?
All in the most good.
All right. Objection removed. So Amendment 2 is adopted. Okay. The only other thing I'd like to do with this, we've heard from at least some of the departments on that they're willing to go with the zero fiscal note. I don't think we heard from the Department of Labor. Can you stick with your fiscal note, sir?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Guy Bell, Assistant Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development. And I was only able to listen to part of the testimony on gavel to gavel, and I apologize that I wasn't here at the beginning of the hearing. Based on what I heard, I think the department is relieved at the relative lack of burden. We were looking at this as being some burden on the department in terms of in large part understanding what we would need to do to comply with this law, and we were looking at the cost of a part-time regulation specialist to assist and learn, or to learn and then assist our divisions with understanding this legislation and applying it appropriately. That's what we were looking at with our small fiscal note, which was largely funded with a non-general fund, as we're primarily a non-general fund agency. We will certainly review this. We're not absolutely bound to a positive fiscal note. This was our effort at trying to understand better the impact of this legislation and applying it appropriately. We would defer to the committee if you feel that it's an overstatement of the impact.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Parson, can you help me walk through the fiscal notes? I think we got 5 or 6 of them here. 5 fiscal notes, is that correct?
I believe that is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so we heard from Hess that they're okay with going. Let's see. So let's just take the Hess fiscal note first for health and social services. I think we heard from the commissioner that they're okay with going zero.
Okay,
see a nod. So I'd go ahead and make that change to the Hess fiscal note. We heard from BBC, they're okay with going zero. Change that one to zero. Let's see, then we have, okay, Department of Law was indeterminate. Okay. And labor workforce, I think, be consistent, just we'll go zero at that one.
More positive, too.
Benefit out here. And then the last one is the Office of Economic Development, and we did feel like they may need some assistance there to coordinate all the information to get to the various departments. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, Mr. Chairman, and to assist the departments in the development of their process.
Okay, so we'll keep that one.
How much is that one?
95,000 for one person. Okay, any other questions or anything else come before the committee on this particular bill?
Quick question.
Sure. There's no more.
Boards and commissions aren't subject to this bill. Regulations of boards and commission, isn't that an exemption that swallows the rule?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, the discussion that always came out around that particular exemption was that boards and commissions confirmed by the legislature are subject to a public process on the confirmation level, and then by and large are also made up of representatives from the industry that are already aware of the needs of the industry. The third problem being is that when a board or commission promulgates a regulation, by and large the costs of that process are borne in fees that go back to the small business. So you're creating a loop where in working on the regulation, you're driving up the cost that, at the end of the day, the small business pays.
That wouldn't apply to fishing game.
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, the separate issue on fishing game was more along the line that emergency allocations or an allocation decision, those decisions, by and large, are made by the Board of Fish and subject to a very, very public process. And saddling them with the impact on small business was a concern that was brought out from the very beginning in the Labor and Commerce Committee. And the committee discussed it and decided that it was too cumbersome, that there is enough defense that goes on for fishermen, and that was the discussion.
So if an agency is subject to this statute and they don't comply, the party that may be aggrieved don't have a cause of action because they're exempted. They don't have a private cause of action. And that doesn't establish any ground to invalidate the regulation. And it only provides judicial review if the Administrative Procedures Act is violated. So where does that really get you?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, the judicial review portion was something that was discussed in the judiciary. And part of the discussion around judicial review was that at the federal level, when the regulatory flexibility was enacted in 1980, it wasn't until 1996 that judicial review became a portion of it. And part of the idea and the reason is that as a new thing for departments in a new process, subjecting their actions to judicial review from the immediate effective date of the act is difficult and problematic. It might be something a future legislature wishes to discuss, but the Judiciary Committee found it problematic, and departments have testified very strongly in previous committees that it's problematic to go that route right now.
The only problem I have in dealing with the Federal Paperwork Reduction Act and dealing with the federal finding of no significant impact provisions of law and regulation, what happens is you give so much weight to bureaucraties and you invest with them the ability to put in language that is so confounding, small business is left so frustrating because they don't really have an ability to affect regulation, because then you have to fight a whole other bureaucracy that's already prepared what's called a regulatory flexibility analysis. And so how's a small businessman supposed to get their mind around that and plus make a living? when they're subject to these regulations.
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, I think that's an incredibly valid concern. The regulatory flexibility analysis and economic effects statement in this bill happened following the public comment period. And that is where the agency should consider the input of public comments. The Department of Commerce and Economic Development advises and assists, goes to the department and says, have you thought for a minute about the actual real-world impacts of your regulation? These economic impact statements and effect analyses and regulatory flexibility analyses perhaps are best used by the Regulatory Review Committee at the legislative level, where there's a record of discussion that the review committee can go back and looking at why a regulation happened and use that to discuss the regulation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Any other discussion? Representative Foster?
Yes, sir. I'd like to move it to the committee.
Revised fiscal. Any objections? Seeing none, committee moves. Or bill moves out of committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I think we have the Director of Insurance here. She's anxiously waiting for us to take up House Bill 147. After that, we'll return back to House Bill 71. Let's see, what do we have? We do have some amendments here. We do have one other person to testify. Ms. Hall, you could tell us what this bill does for the record who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance, and probably on Friday afternoon talking about insurance is not anybody's favorite thing to do. So I will try to be brief. House Bill 147 proposes statutory changes that will make the regulation of insurance more efficient for the division, more uniform for industry, and at the same time providing increased protections to consumers. I'm going to limit my introductory remarks to broad areas. I'm not going to go through all the pages of the bill, but if there are questions on any particular section, I'd certainly be happy to address those. The first section of statutory changes are in the licensing areas. Our licensing of individual agents and brokers. The proposed changes in those sections are to streamline the licensing process, and we continue to make efforts to conform to national models and standards to make sure that Alaska's practices are applicable and maintain some conformity with what's going on a national basis. We have in these sections made notification of suspension of an agent's license and revocation of an insurer's certificate of authority, the insurer's obligation. We will no longer require insurers to file their appointments with us, but they must terminate in writing any of their agent appointments, and they must notify us if an agent is terminated for cause. We also, in our licensing sections, will allow license renewals, notifications to go out by means other than mail. We are trying to convert to an electronic licensing, and I think that will bring greater efficiencies both to those we regulate and to the division staff. Second area of change in the bill deals with surplus lines. Surplus lines insurance, it becomes a little bit different. These are insurers who do not file to operate in Alaska. They don't have to file forms and rates with us. So we have some different statutory requirements. Last year, we made a number of changes to statutes after the operation of a task force that worked with industry, with brokers, and with the division. And the changes here are minor. They are basically cleanup changes. We have a couple sections that deal with insurance company deposits. One removes the ability to use safety deposit boxes. That is never used, and we don't really think people should stick their insurance deposits in safety deposit boxes. The other would permit the director to transfer an insurer deposit to our guarantee fund if that is assigned through the solvency procedures. There are several sections that deal with a commodity called health discount plans. These are plans that look like insurance, use the same terminology as insurance, but they're not insurance. From 2000 to 2002, nationally, over 200,000 of these plans were sold and resulted in $252 million worth of unpaid claims. In order to protect Alaskan consumers, we are seeking to add more specific authority to regulate these types of products. We have had in Alaska, you may have seen, late night TV or fax types of things that advertise for $79.99 you can insure, you can provide coverage, I don't use the word insure, for your family. Generally, the ones we've seen that have been operating in Alaska advertise a network of physicians, and the physicians have never heard of them. So we are seeking additional regulatory oversight for misrepresentation of terms and making these types of plans fall under our unfair trade practices. There are a number of sections that deal with third-party administrators. A third-party administrator is someone who provides administrative services typically for health insurance plans. There are changes in the statute proposed here that would require registration of additional third-party administrators. There are exemptions from registration, and they would have to certify to us that they meet one of those exemptions. But again, it's really more of a cleanup provision. There is, in the current bill, before you talk about amendments, there is what's called an owner-contractor insurance program statutory language. This type of a program is written for large construction projects, covers usually the liability and workers' compensation insurance for all the subcontractors on a single project in one policy. Those are very beneficial for large construction projects, and currently we have rules for those published in the Workers' Compensation Manual. We are seeking to have some of those rules codified in statute. There have been some attempts over the years, as long ago as 1995, to expand those programs to operations and maintenance, ongoing types of operations. And it is our belief this particular proposal was proposed by the independent insurance agents. I am very supportive of it. I think allowing these types of programs to expand into other areas would have a detrimental effect on our market. Most of you have heard me for some time now talk about the insurance market, and we have a lot of discussion about the workers' compensation markets today. As we find ways to take more premium out of our overall market, as we reduce that, our market becomes less and less attractive to insurance companies. That is my regulatory responsibility. I've also had contacts from a number of subcontractors who have their own insurance program. If they are required to take out chunks of payroll and put somewhere else under any type of another plan, their own ability to structure their programs, whether insured or self-insured, is hampered. I would be happy to answer questions about that. A couple other just general provisions. We have added in Section 26 some standards for rate making in health insurance lines that doesn't currently exist. Statutory standards for rate making are typically rates may not be excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory. We've added that to health insurance. It does not currently exist. And there are a couple minor changes in financial statements for title insurance companies. And with that, I would be happy to entertain questions or go into any particular provisions in any more detail if any of the committee members would like.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hall. I think you've done a good job of explaining the bill. Is there any questions by the committee? Go ahead.
I'd like to nominate this bill for the most esoteric bill we've dealt with this year. That truly, congratulations on the process of shepherding something like this through the entire legislative process. I know it needs to be done, but it can't be easy.
Thank you, Representative Hawker.
Yes, and I think you'll find that this committee is much more user-friendly than perhaps some of the other committees that you've gone through with this bill. you have a zero fiscal note, so it's good with that. So. There are some amendments, so it looks like you've requested. I'm assuming you want these. They've got my name on it.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do want these.
All right, well, I'll move them.
And I think you were kind enough to put them forward. Thank you.
As long as you explain them.
I will be happy to do that.
Move amendment number one.
Okay. Ms. Hall? Amendment number one are technical changes that how our regulatory authority and where we're really looking to make sure that people that are providing coverage under various entities that for the cost of medical care are required to use a licensed third-party administrator. Like this is, well, it doesn't look like, and it is esoteric, Representative Hawker. It is an attempt to clean up our already esoteric, very lengthy, complex title.
Very good. Any questions?
We're all removed by objection.
Okay, objection is removed. So amendment one is adopted. Okay, I'll move to amendment number two.
Mr. Chairman, can
I? Sure.
Just on amendment number one, on page 15, line 25, if you delete and, it reads, whether authorized or unauthorized insured may not underwrite.
That's amendment number three, Representative Wyrock. I'm sorry.
Yeah, he went back to amendment number one.
Amendment one, but if you take and delete insurer off of line 16,
Okay, thank you. Okay, so it has been objected to. Ms. Hall.
Amendment number two is a restatement of section 3 in the current G version, the CS that's G that we were discussing. It was put in error in chapter 12 of the insurance title. You'll note it now refers to 2136 instead of 2112. There are a couple minor wording changes, but this is a technical amendment, even though it takes three pages to do so, because of an incorrect placement of the language.
I'm sorry, are you on amendment two?
I thought so.
G2? No, there's amendment three. Amendment two, yeah, G1.
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 Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No wonder I'm backwards.
We have our G's out of the order.
Well, the first comments I made were on number one. We've already adopted one, so okay. I've already talked about this one because that's what I said for amendment one.
She can argue a different argument for a separate amendment. It's still esoteric and argument work we never noticed. Yeah.
I'm embarrassed now. The comments I've already made on this amendment are still my comments.
Okay. Well, let me just make sure I understand where we're at here.
This is awful.
We're on page 11, lines 28 to 29. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
We have removed on page 11.
Lines 28 and 29.
Lines 28 and 29.
And you're inserting this language.
And we're inserting, instead of a self-funded multiple employer welfare arrangement in insurance ease known as a MEWA, see, I don't use acronyms, any person issued or required to obtain a certificate of authority, that will make them an insurer if you have to obtain in other places a certificate of authority to provide coverage.
Okay. No objections to amendment number two. Okay, we'll move amendment number three.
Now we'll let you go.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just a quick question on amendment two, since I was here just to back up real quick on one portion of the amendment.
Yeah, actually, we do have another person to testify too.
I should
we should take all testimony before we start doing amendments. So why don't we hold off on Amendment 3? And let's see, who do we have to testify? Mr. Bryce?
Yes,
I think it's, yeah, just you and Tom Bryce.
Tom,
I apologize. No. I start on that amendments here.
Shorter people must have been here before I just busted my knees. My name is Tom Bryce. I represent the Alaska State District Council of Laborers. That organization consists of the private employee unions that are in Local 341 and Laborers Local 942. We also represent the public employees, Local 71, the blue-collar workers. Local 71 has been tracking this piece of legislation from the beginning. Under the in its original version, we had some issues that were taken care of in Labor and Commerce. We had no objections to the House Bill 147 Labor Commerce version. There are some questions that may come up under Amendment Number 2, possibly, but I need to get that back to our council.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your consideration,
you.
Mr. Chair and committee members.
Yeah, any question? Have you had a chance to look at the amendments?
I picked up the amendments this afternoon right as I came in here.
And you've already adopted Number 1, I guess Number 2.
We adopted Number 1. We can rescind on Number 2 if necessary.
I just had a question on Amendment Number 2, and that is the portion of Amendment. Do you have it in front of you, Mr. Bryce?
Yes, sir.
Ms. Hall. It's the portion of the amendment on line number 5-6 in health insurance or to provide coverage for the cost of medical care. Does that affect the medical trust that may be administered by your union, or what does that mean to you all?
Maybe that would be a better question for Director Hall. I'm looking at, you know, just in terms of grammar, whether or not it says, whether or not, or to the last clause, which is to provide coverage for the cost of medical care, whether or not that's incorporated under individuals that are required to receive a certificate of authority to participate or whether or not that's a separate section. And my concern might be that if it is a separate section, in other words, all of a sudden we're redefining the public employee health trust as insurance agents.
Through the chair, Representative Weirach, I would agree with Mr. Bryce's statement that the pieces that were controversial regarding the health trusts are removed. There is no intent in this. This is talking about a person issued or required to obtain a certificate of authority, and the union health trust are not required to obtain a certificate of authority. This is directed right now at, and I don't want to use insurances, self-funded multiple employer welfare arrangements, which are different. They are currently required to have certificate of authority from us. Mm-hmm. And in things such as the high-risk plan.
Everybody's happy.
Everybody's happy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I like it when everybody's happy.
Okay. Okay, there is no one else to testify. We were on Amendment 2. It actually was adopted. Do you want to rescind those? Okay. Amendment 2 then stands as adopted. We'll go on to Amendment 3.
Amendment 3.
Go ahead, Director Hall.
It is Friday afternoon, right? Amendment 3 is the owner-controlled insurance programs. That this does not change what's in the current bill, but it moves it to a different chapter in the insurance title. It moves it from 21-21-12 that is in the current CS to 21-36. And I did address this in my original remarks. I would be happy to answer any questions about it.
Most okay with the content. I'm just making sure it fits here. Okay. Any questions on Amendment 3?
Yes.
Go ahead, Dr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Chairman. We get to put all our debate agenda up here, my friend Representative Croft. Just as this, the limitation, and this is just informational, if you could. We've got Section 24 here that now for the first time clearly spells out that except as provided in 21-12-140, ensure whether authorized or unauthorized, if we've modified it, may not underwrite an owner-controlled insurance program. And let's see, that reference is being changed later on in the amendment. But then we're authorizing it here. These seem to be authorized only in the circumstances of a major construction project. And it's my own education. What's going on here?
These programs are designed for major construction projects, so used across the country. The oil pipeline was insured under, it's affectionately known as an OSIP, an owner-controlled or contractor-controlled insurance program. It isn't something that doesn't already occur, Representative Hawker. These are programs, and they're currently, the rules, the definitions for these are in our workers' compensation manual, and I think they need to be codified. And we currently say they have to be approved by the division, and I'm looking to codify that. It is not a change in how these programs are used. It is a prohibition against expanding them into other types of things than large construction projects.
I've never encountered one of these pieces before.
They are not particularly common. We typically do not have projects that are insured in this manner, but it has come up at times. It was just as an anecdotal thing when I was reviewing things back as far as 1995, I found testimony that I had given to the Division of Insurance. So, I mean, there have been issues with this for a number of years.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You're more than welcome.
Okay. Any other questions, concerns on Amendment 3? Not.
All we move on to Mr. Chairman.
Objection's been removed. Amendment 3 is adopted. Any other questions for the director? Okay.
Yes, sir. I'll go ahead and move out of case 2147. Not planning. As amended, submitted by the recommendation.
Any objections? Seeing none. Thank you. Thank you, Director Hall.
Thank you.
Okay. This point in time, we'll go back to the original bill. Bill 71, I believe the amendments are being passed out. Ms. Cunningham? Okay, Ms. Cunningham, again, for the record, if you could tell us who we are and
for the record, Suzanne Cunningham, staff to Representative Meyer, and hopefully I'm here not to screw this bill up anymore.
Okay.
Is that a technical term?
Not sure.
We could define it on page 8.
All right. So, what has happened since we last
we are working with the Department of Revenue. We have drafted two amendments. The first one is to page 2, lines 13 through 17. I can explain it first, or if you'd like to.
Okay, I'll move amendment 1. Objection, sir. Moved and objected.
Basically, the amendment says that to qualify for the production tax under A of this section, exploration expenditures must be incurred on work performed on or after July 1st, 2003 and before July 1, 2007, which is the way the current statute is written, the current program. And then we've added except that an exploration expenditure, in whole or in part, south of 68 degrees 15 minutes north latitude, must be incurred for work performed before July 1, 2010. So it effectively extends south of 6815 north until 2010 and does not affect the current program, which is in place till 2007. And the second part of the amendment is on page 6, line 12, section 8. After the provisions of the section do not apply to, deleted all material except for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We did keep that in there as part of the original resources bill.
Okay, and when you refer to for people who may be listening and wondering what south of 68 degrees and 15 minutes north latitude, that's basically south of the Brooklyn, is that
yes.
In general?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Okay, questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Lieutenant Hawker, you ready? We can go on down line here. So if you're ready, go. Go ahead, Lieutenant Hawker.
Technical question on page 6, line 4, and then a permanent sentence word.
Yes.
And we're
going
to go over and read our way through this.
Okay.
The beginning line, page 6, line 12.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just strictly grammar of sentence construction here. The provisions of this section do not apply to. Okay. Now we delete what continues from there if we get to the word latitude. On line 15, correct?
That is correct, Representative Hawker. Two words need to be
used. Apply to or on the Alaska Network. Okay.
That's correct.
That does work. Okay. That does work. Thank you.
Very good. Thanks for questioning that. Or
yeah.
Representative
Schnell. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was more of a look at lines 13 through 17. And on amendment number one, lines 13 through 17, I'm concerned on page 2, we have added in language except that exploration expenditure for the Cook Inlet prospect must have occurred for work performed on or after July 1st of 2005, which would be current. I'm concerned, and maybe I'm not reading it correctly, that this would allow credits to be garnered on work from July 1st of 03, which would retroactively do this. My concern is that we are changing the legislation from the 25 mile to the 10 mile, and also possibly inside the 3 mile with the commissioner's approval. And I'm sure while there may be some that like that idea, that wasn't the original intent, just to allow them to take credit for work already performed under the existing program. So I don't know how we fix that yet. Or if you might have comments on it.
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, when we were looking at redrafting this subsection or this this section B, and I guess maybe this is more a question for you: are the changes that were incorporated under SB 163 into 71? The effective date of those changes is July 1, 2005. Okay.
Yes.
Then there will need to be an exemption for the Cook Inlet July 1, 2005 to 2010. It'll need to be a separate exemption.
If we can add that back in.
Yes, we
can. Do you want to make that a conceptual number?
But 4 or something?
Can you just change the date?
Can you change the date?
Yeah. Would Dan be online? Dan Dickerson, are you still online?
Thank you. Representative Trenault and Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely correct. And the way I would do it, and I'm sorry I had misunderstood the amendment as it was proposed, is all the current language existing on page 2 after the 2010 date would continue to be there. So it was my understanding that the amendment that amendment language we were working on that is in Amendment 1 would only be changing language in lines 13, 14, and 15, but the new language added that starts with the 2010 would continue precisely the way you have it here, because I think your concern is exactly correct. The new definition of a cook in the prospect and the new rules should only be applied prospectively. So I think that's a very accurate observation. I think doing it that way will correct that.
Through the chair, just one point. However, on line 15, we had to delete that 2010 there because the current program is to 2007, and that's was the concern, was that people who are participating in the current program that would not be extended to 2010. We had to leave the 2007 there.
Okay, but
correct. Mr. Chairman, if I might just suggest, if the amendment is used to replace all the language through, and I guess including the word 2010 that's on line 15, and then the clause that starts with except after that continues on through to the end of the sentence, I believe that does what folks have intent.
Okay. I think we can conceptually agree to that.
Well, one more time for me, and I apologize, but that got distracted by whoever that was that came in. What are you going to do on page 6? Because it seems to me we created our page 6 problem all over again, even with this amendment. If the provisions don't apply, B has to apply, because that's the very reason it kept the things north in. It seemed to me what you could do is eliminate Section 8, I think, given Section B's rewrite, and if we fix Cook Inlet correctly for 05.
Through the chair, Representative Croft, the rewrite of Section 8 on page 6, L would say the provisions of this section, so that section would mean 4355025 would not apply to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So none of this section would pertain to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. That's what the amendment on page 6 is purporting to do.
It was my mistake. Then it's written right, and I appreciate that. I was seeing add in where it said delete all that language. Thank you. So now you're going to do a conceptual amendment to say don't go retroactive on cooking only stuff that was truly incentivized by this deal.
There's two different programs until July 1st of 2005. They're under the existing program. After July 1st, and the expenditures would fall underneath the new program.
Okay. Yeah. Then that's fine. Thank you.
In both cases, the co-terminus, their date for terminating,
correct,
they shut it down. Okay, so you have a conceptual amendment to Amendment 1, or is that a separate amendment you want to make?
I would just make a conceptual amendment to Amendment 1.
Okay.
That ties back in the language of the expiration expenditure for the Spur Cook Inlet prospect must be incurred for work performed on or after July 1st, 2005, and before July 1st of 2010.
Mr. Chairman, I would remove my objection to Amendment 1 as amended. Is that correct?
Okay, good. Is that as clear as drawing that? Madam Secretary, you have the conceptual amendment? Okay, very good. All right, so there's no objection to Amendment 1 as amended, then that is adopted. Okay, Amendment number 2. I'll move Amendment 2.
Object for discussion, sir.
Okay, Ms. Cunningham.
In working with the Department of Revenue, we just wanted to clarify, clarify, and clarify once again. The amendment starts on page 2, line 1, following under. What the amendment basically does is it reinserts section B and C so that it's just very clear that in order to get the credit, you have to meet the qualifications under B, which sets out the time frames that exploration work occurs, and also C, which is the 3 mile. And we made the conforming amendment on page 2, line 3, page 2, line 7, and page 2, line 9. It just clarifies what that it's got to be B and those further subsections.
This isn't the issue of 40 to 80. This is the issue of, are we still good on the timing?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, that is correct. If you look at section 2, which is the B subsection that it, mm-hmm. that it references, you can see that it sets out the time frame, which is 2010 or 2007, seismic or geophysical exploration cost, exploration wells, the cost must be incurred by an explorer, it must be for goods or services. So it just sets out, to get that 20%, you've got to do B and C. To get that 20%, you've got to do B and D. To get that 40%, it's got to be B, C, and D. To get the 40% that includes the seismic, it has to be B and E. I mean, it just clarifies. So, and it reinforces that there's no possible way to get more than 40%.
Yeah, that was the concern we had. We didn't want to get 80%.
That's
nice to have good staff, isn't it?
Yeah, she knows this bill pretty well. Any other questions? Okay, then amendment 2 is about. Oh, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Said, how could you remove your objection?
I think what we have come to here is we have, I believe, maintained the intent behind the original line detail bill we passed a year or whatever it was in the prior session. Mm-hmm. And I think we've made it very clear that there is no circumstance that we get 80% credit. And so that, believing that's where we're at, I remove my objection to the amendment, sir.
Okay. I believe that's where we're at. And I think this does clarify that. Okay, so amendment number 2 is adopted. No other objections? Okay. So we have the bill back before us as amended. Comments, questions? Let's have the other tax online revenues here. Cunningham still here. Anything else?
Just a question, Mr. Chairman. Since we've done a good bit on the fly here, it's the DNR or revenue folks been tracking us, and somebody says, yep, we're still right on right where we want to be.
Barbara Revenue, why don't you come up and just assure us that we haven't done something here without your instructions.
For the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Special Assistant to the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and we've been tracking through. We've worked with the staff, to Representative Meyer, and I believe that the bill is a big expansion from what the original bill, but it doesn't, it preserves the intent and certainly makes very clear the statute as we intended to do.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other discussion? I guess just for the record, I would like to declare a potential conflict here. I have no idea who's going to take advantage of these expiration credits, but when I'm not here, I do work for another oil company who could take advantage of this. So based on that, I'd like to be excused from voting.
Objection.
Just like on the floor, you guys.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I had always understood that it's not necessary to declare a conflict in the committee, but on the floor it is.
You're probably right, Representative Warwick. It just dawned on me as we were working through this bill that perception could be there that I have a conflict, and I just wanted to put it on record.
And Mr. Chairman, I just think it's important that I don't declare conflicts at all in any of the bills moving through here, even though I may have a conflict, because I feel it's I'm legally required and ethically required to do so on the floor, and I'm committed.
Okay.
Unless there's some major issue or something. But otherwise, I think that's the rule.
Well, we'll try to get a ruling on that, because I think sometimes, you know, one vote in committee can make a difference on whether a bill leaves committee.
Yeah,
I'm not sure it will in this case.
I just want to play by the rules, and I don't think...
Yeah, let's ask. It's always been the floor, not committee, but I'd be curious.
Okay, Representative Harper.
And thank you, and Mr. Chairman. My understanding of the circumstances has paralleled that of Representative Whiterock's. Deferring to the current guidance of the chair, I would also like to declare that I do have a conflict. My wife is employed in a major oil company in the state, and they may very well take advantage of this program in some manner or fashion. And I would also ask to be excused from voting.
Anybody else? I guess we're all recipients of the current fund dividend.
You're also with all of you.
I use oil.
Okay, well, whoever wants to declare the conflict on the floor, they can. I will try to get a ruling as far as committee work. Okay, Representative Foster.
Yes, sir. I'll go ahead and vote out 8370. I'm not a committee with individual
any objections? Seeing none, bill passes.
Mr. Chairman, I would recommend that you're going to ask for the ruling, Barbara Craig. Just ask Barbara Craig.
Okay. I was thinking Pam
Cook, is
it? Yeah.
She was good for us.
Okay. All right.
Alleged legal.
Alleged legal, yes. Okay. All right. Well, good. Conclude all the work for this week. Won't meet this Saturday. But next Monday, we'll take up a little bill called SB 155.
Great bill, sir.
Okay. And then SB 93 is fishing permit, vessel license fee. Is that yours?
On Monday?
Is that your bill? Is that for
Monday.
No.
No, that's the administration bill.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Monday?
Yeah, probably Monday now, yes. And also SB 51, public assistance programs. Tuesday, property casualty insurance, and then HB 94 is elections, SB 63, seatbelt road signs, and on Wednesday, House Bill 13, school construction bond reimbursement, House Bill 252, sport fishing, House Bill 187 and 188 pertaining to the Merida Hess. Thursday, workers' comp, let's see, that's House Bill 31, workers' comp, disease presumption. House Bill 231, Human Service Grant Eligibility. House Bill 101, Sex Trafficking and Tourism. Is that yours, Representative Roberts? I think it gets to Miss Cunningham.
Strangest name that we've got this year.
House Bill 53, Children in Need. And then Friday, House Bill 7, Unemployment Compensation. House Bill 146, Trafficking of Persons. And House Bill 220, Mental Health Patient Rights. I would imagine we'll be 24 hours sometime next week.
Monday?
Okay. So this may not be relevant anymore, but that's what we have planned. So with that, everybody, anything else come for the committee? Have a good weekend.
Are we next time?